The rock was of such an unusual colour and texture that they were both struck by it. They turned aside to study it while the mules went on downwards, the clatter of their receding hoofbeats and the voices of the men echoing and reverberating weirdly in this confined and unearthly place.
"It looks like some monstrous gargoyle, gushing water through its mouth," Royan whispered, looking up at the cleft and at those strange rock formations. "I can imagine how the ancient Egyptians, led by Taita and Prince Memnon, would have been moved if they had ever reached this place. What mystical connotations they would have attributed to such a natural phenomenon."
Nicholas was silent, studying her face. Her eyes were dark with awe, and her expression solemn. In this setting, she reminded him strongly of a portrait that he had in his collection at Quentin Park. It was a fragment of a fresco from the Valley of the Kings, depicting a Ramessidean princess. "Why should that surprise you?" he asked himself. "The very same blood runs in her veins." She turned to face him.
"Give me hope, Nicky. Tell me that I have not dreamed all this. Tell me that we are going to find what we are looking for, and that we are going to vindicate Duryad's death."
Her face was upturned to his, and it seemed to glow under the light dew of perspiration and the strength of her commitment. He was seized by an almost overwhelming urge to take her up in his arms and kiss those moistly parted lips. But instead he turned away and started down the trail. He dared not look back at her until he had himself fully under control. After a while he heard her quick, light tread on the rock behind him. They went on down in silence, and he was so preoccupied that he was unprepared for the sudden, stunning vista that opened abruptly before them. They stood high on a ledge above the sub-gorge of the Nile. Below them was a mighty cauldron of red rock 500 feet deep. The main flow of the legendary river plunged in a green torrent into the shadowy abyss. It was so deep that the sunlight did not reach down into it. Beside them, the sparser waters of the Dandera River took the same leap, falling white as an egret's feather, twisting and blowing in the false wind of the gorge. In the depths, the waters mingled, churning and roiling together in a welter of foam, turning upon themselves like a great wheel, weighty and viscous as oil, until at last they found the exit gorge and tore away down it with irresistible force and power.
"You sailed through that in a boat?" Royan asked, with awe in her voice.
"Well, we were young and foolish then," Nicholas said with a sad little smile that was haunted by old memories. They were silent for a long while. Then Royan said softly,
"One can see how this would have stopped Taita and his prince as they came upstream."
She looked about her, and then pointed down the gorge towards the west.
"They certainly could never have come up the sub-gorge itself. They must have followed the line of the top of the cliffs, right along here where we are standing."
Her voice took on an edge of excitement at the thought. "Unless they came up the other side of the river," Nicholas suggested to tease her, and her face fell.
"Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Of course, it's possible. How would we ever cross over if we find no evidence on this side?"
"Let's consider that only when it's forced upon us. We have enough to contend with as it is, without looking for more hardships." Again they were silent, both of them considering the magnitude and uncertainty of the task that they had taken on. Then Royan roused herself.
"Where is the monastery? I can see no sign of it."
"It's in the cliff right under our feet."
"Will we camp down there?"
"Oh, I doubt it. Let's catch up with Boris and find out what he intends to do." They followed the trail along the edge of the cauldron and came up with the mule caravan at a spot where the track forked. One branch turned away from the river into a wooded depression, while the other still hugged the rim rock. Boris was waiting for them, and he indicated the track that led away from the river.
"There is a good campsite up there in the trees, where I stayed last time I hunted down here."
There were several tall, wild fig trees throwing shade across this glade, and a spring of fresh water at the head. To minimize the loads, Boris had not carried tents down into the gorge, So as soon as the mules were unloaded, he set his men to building three small thatched huts for their accommodation, and to digging a pit latrine well away from the spring. While this work was going on, Nicholas beckoned to Royan and Tessé, and the three of them set off to explore the monastery. Where the trail forked, Tessé led them along the path that skirted the clifftop, and soon they came to a broad rock staircase that descended the cliff face. There was a party of white-robed monks coming up the stone stairway, and Tessé stopped briefly to chat to them. As they went on, she told Nicholas and Royan, "Today is Katira, the eve of the festival of Timkat, which begins tomorrow. They are very excited. It is one of the major events of the religious year." "What does the festival celebrate?" Royan asked. "It is not part of the church calendar in Egypt." "It is the Ethiopian Epiphany, celebrating the baptism of Christ," Tessé explained. "During the ceremony, the tabo will be taken down to the river to be rededicated and revitalized, and the acolytes will receive baptism, as did Jesus Christ at the hand of the Baptist." They followed the staircase down the sheer cliff face. The treads of the steps had been dished by the passage of bare feet over the centuries. Down they went, with the great cauldron of the Nile boiling and hissing and steaming with spray hundreds of feet below them. Suddenly they came out onto a wide terrace that had been hewn by man's hand from the living rock. The red rock overhung it, forming a roof to the cloister with arches of stone left in place by the ancient builders to support it. The interior wall of the long covered terrace was riddled with the entrances to the catacombs beyond. Over the ages, the cliff face had been mined and burrowed to form the halls and cells, the vestibules, churches and shrines of the monastic community which had inhabited them for well over 1,000 years. There were a group of monks seated along the length of the terrace. Some of them were listening to one of the deacons reading aloud from an illuminated copy of the scriptures. "So many of them are illiterate," Tessé sighed. "The Bible must be read and explained to even the monks, for most of them are unable to read it for themselves." This was what the Church of Constantine was like. "The Church of Byzantium," Nicholas pointed out quietly. "It remains the church of cross and book, of elaborate and sumptuous ritual in a predominantly illiterate world today." As they wandered slowly down the cloister, they passed other seated groups who, under the direction of a precentor, were chanting and singing the Amharic psalms and hymns. From the interior of the cells and caves there came the hum of voices raised in prayer or supplication, and the air was thick with the smell of human occupation that had taken place over hundreds of years. It was the smell of wood smoke and incense, of stale food and excrement, of sweat and piety, of suffering and of sickness. Amongst the groups of monks were the pilgrims who had made the journey, or been carried by their relatives down into the gorge to make petition to the saint, or to seek from him a cure for their disease and suffering. There were blind children weeping in their mother's arms, and lepers with the flesh rotting and falling from their bones, and still others in the coma of sleeping sickness or some other terrible tropical affliction. Their whines and moans of agony blended with the chanting of the monks, and with the distant clamour of the Nile as it cascaded into the cauldron. They came at last to the entrance to the cavern cathedral of St. Frumentius. It was a circular opening like the mouth of a fish, but the surrounds of the portals were painted with a dense border of stars and crosses and of saintly heads. The portraits were primitive and rendered in ochre and soft earthy tones that were all the more appealing for their childlike simplicity. The eyes of the saints were huge and outlined in charcoal, their expressions tranquil and benign. A deacon in a grubby green velvet robe guarded the entrance, but when Tessé spoke to him, he smiled and nodded and gestured for them to enter. The lintel was low, and Nicholas had to duck his head to pass under it. But on the far side he raised it again and looked about him in amazement. The roof of the cavern was so high that it was lost in the gloom. The rock walls were covered with murals, a celestial host of angels and archangels who flickered and wavered in the light of the candles and oil lamps. They were partially obscured by the long tapestry banners that hung down the walls, grimy with incense soot, their fringes frayed and tattered. On one of these, St. Michael rode a prancing white horse. On another, the Virgin knelt at the foot of the cross, while above her the pale body of Christ bled from the wound of the Roman spear in his side. This was the outer nave of the church. In the far wall, the doorway to the middle chamber was guarded by a massive pair of wooden doors that stood open. Three of them crossed the stone floor, picking their way between the kneeling petitioners and pilgrims in their rags and tatters, in their misery and their religious ecstasy. In the feeble light of the lamps and the blue haze of incense smoke, they seemed lost souls languishing eternally in the outer darkness of purgatory. The visitors reached the set of three stone steps that led up to the inner doors, but their way was blocked at the threshold by two robed deacons in tall, flat-topped hats. One of these addressed Tessé sternly. "They will not even let us enter the quiddist, the middle chamber," Tessé told them regretfully. "Beyond lies the Magdas, the Holy of Holies." They peered past the guards, and in the gloom of the quiddist could just make out the door to the inner sanctum. "Only the ordained priests are allowed to enter the Magdas, for it contains the tabor and the entrance to the tomb of the saint." Disappointed and frustrated, they made their way out of the cavern and back along the terrace. They ate their dinner under a sky full of stars. The air was still stiflingly hot, and clouds of mosquitoes hovered just out of range of the repellents with which they had all smeared their exposed skin.
"Ha! And so, English, I have got you where you wanted to be. Now, how are you going to find this animal that you have come so far to hunt?"
The vodka was making Boris belligerent again. "At first light, I want you to send out your trackers to work the country downstream from here," Nicholas told him. "Dick Dick are usually active in the early morning, and again late in the afternoon."
"Ha! You are teaching your grandpapa to skin a cat,"
said Boris, mangling the metaphor. He poured himself another vodka. "Tell them to check the spoor," Nicholas deliberately laboured his point. "I imagine that the tracks of the striped variety will look very similar to those of the common dick-dick. If they find indications, then they must sit quietly along the edge of the thickest patches of bush and watch for any movement of the animals. Dick-dick are very territorial. They won't stray far from their own turf."
Da, I will tell them. But what will you do? Will you spend the day in camp with the ladies, English?"
He grinned slyly.
"Ha! If you are lucky, you may soon not need separate huts."
He guffawed at his own wit, and Tessé looked distressed and stood up with the excuse that she was going to the kitchen hut to supervise the chef. Nicholas ignored the boorish pleasantry. "Royan and I will work the riverine bush along the banks of the Dandera River. It looked very promising habitat for Dick Dick. Warn your people to keep clear of the river. I don't want the game disturbed." They left camp the next morning in the glimmer of the dawn. Nicholas carried the Rigby rifle and a light day pack and led Royan along the bank of the Dandera. They moved slowly, stopping every dozen paces to look and listen. The thickets were alive with the sounds and movements of the small mammals and birds. The Ethiopians do not have a hunting tradition, and I imagine the monks never disturb the wildlife here in the gorge. He pointed to the tracks of a small antelope in the moist earth of the bank. "Bushbuck," he told her. "Menelik's bushbuck, unique to this part of the world, a much sought-after trophy." "Do you really expect to find your great-grandfather's dick-dick?" she asked. "You seemed so determined when you discussed it with Boris."
"Of course not,"
he grinned. "I think the old man made it up. It should rather have been named Harper's Shimmerer. It probably was the skin of a striped mongoose that he used after all. We Harpers didn't get on in the world by always sticking to the literal truth." They paused to watch a Takaza sunbird fluttering over a bunch of yellow blossoms on a creeper high above them in the canopy of the riverine forest. The tiny bird's plumage sparkled like a tiara of emeralds. Still, it gives us a wonderful excuse to fossick about in the bushes. He glanced back to make certain that they were well clear of the camp, and then gestured for her to sit beside him on a fallen tree trunk. So, let's get it clear in our minds what we're looking for. You tell me. We are looking for the remains of a funerary temple, or the remains of the necropolis where the workers lived while they were excavating Pharaoh Mamo's tomb. Any sort of masonry or stonework, he agreed, especially some sort of column or monument. Taita's stone testament, she nodded. It should be engraved or chiselled with hieroglyphics, probably badly weathered, fallen over, covered with vegetation, I don't know, anything at all. We are fishing blind in dark waters. Well, why are we still sitting here? Let's start fishing.